This is Storage Unpacked. Subscribe at storageunpacked.com.
This is Chris Evans recording a Storage Unpacked podcast. And today I'm on tour. I'm in Los Altos with Neeraj Tolia. Hi, how are you doing?
Doing great, Chris. Great to be here.
So you are the founder, co-founder?
I'm the co-founder at Cast, and we are a cloud-native data management startup based in the Bay Area, so yes.
Co-founder and CEO.
That is correct.
Perfect. Yeah. So yeah, what a lovely day. We're sitting in your boardroom, and we're taking the opportunity to go back and review something I wrote a little while ago, which some people seem to think is, let's call it, possibly a controversial approach to deciding how we manage storage with containers. And that's this whole idea of, you know, should we use block, should we use file? And obviously you've reached out and we've chatted on a number of occasions because you're in this particular area. Mm-hmm. And we just thought we'd go through that. But before we do that, just give people a bit more of a flavor about your background and the technology that the company does. And I think that will help everybody understand, you know, why it's going to be a good conversation.
Sure. So let me start off with a little bit about my background. I've been working on storage systems since 2002 at this point in time. I worked on them for my PhD at Carnegie Mellon, and then next generation storage class memories at HP Labs, did a distributed file system startup, Maginetics that EMC acquired, got turned into the EMC Cloud Boost product, got exposed to Kubernetes, and now doing Kasten, which is actually a German word for box or container, so quite apropos. And looking at cloud-native data management. So not doing primary storage anymore, but we work with a large number of vendors out there. We have customers in production. It's interesting seeing the patterns develop in the Kubernetes and OpenShift ecosystem.
And everybody's really into data management at the moment, aren't they? That's a big area.
It is a hot space to be in right now, but for all the right reasons,
yeah.
Because that's where the value is.
Yeah, perfect. Okay, let's set some background then, and let's talk about exactly where this discussion came from. Now, I think, I mean, it's a while since I wrote this post and I sent it back out. I think I must have written it sort of a couple of years ago, maybe. Actually, probably almost exactly 2 years ago. And the reason it came about is because I looked at a few things that I was seeing on a number of vendor presentations where traditional vendors were saying, here's our storage system, it's block, it's LUNS, and we can just plug it into a container environment. I'm looking at it thinking, I don't agree with that. Mm-hmm. I think actually those systems have got so many bits and pieces that are lacking that that isn't the right way. And actually I thought file was a better solution. And the reason I thought file was a better solution was because it gives you so much more metadata around the data than say a block system could. What's your opinion on that? Because I have a feeling that you might or you might not agree with me.
So there's definitely a little bit of disagreement here when I look at my point of view on this.
Yeah.
But from your top level view in this article that you wrote a couple of years ago, I think the way you qualify storage systems is correct. When you talk about the need for metadata, the need for resiliency, the need for reliability, and how it adapts to this new world, and should we just take everything from the old and try to, you know, shove it into the new, all of those things make sense. But I think the choice of technology or that block is going to be here to stay. And it has a number of advantages that make sense for maybe 70%+ of the use cases out there. And I'd love to dig into more details as to why I believe so and have this conversation today.
Okay. All right. So let's think about the differences between the two types of the ways of mapping storage. In my naive way of looking at it, and I'm hoping you can correct me on this, I look at the way that I see storage being added to things like containers and Kubernetes and those environments in the block sense as being block devices that are presented to a container or a pod and then are formatted up with a file system and onto which the customer then puts their data.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think that seems like a reasonable assumption.
Mm-hmm.
And the first reason for me thinking that file is better is because immediately I've taken a block device and I've now just put a file system over the top. So surely I've created what I could have done with a file system in the first place. Is that a reasonable view of where we are in the market today with that technology, or do you think things have moved on in the last 2 years?
So I think the usage pattern is correct, right? There have been new abstractions that have come in, such as the container storage interface. But overall, I think what you described is very accurate as to how the pattern works. But I believe that when you go look at versus block versus file, that even though the interface presented to the application is often the file system, whether it be local or shared, there is a lot of difference in terms of how that technology has to be implemented that makes a very significant impact to performance and the use case, and sometimes reliability too in that mix.
Okay, let's dig down and explain, you know, what you mean by that, because traditionally we see block as being the most performing type of storage.
Yeah.
Although I would qualify that and say that we're seeing technologies coming along now that are challenging that from a file perspective. Mm-hmm. But why would you think that scenario is a better choice in terms of connecting block devices?
Sure. So I think simply because of a couple of different reasons. One of them, that when you, most block devices, the majority of them are used in single reader-writer mode. So there's no sharing of that block device. And with Kubernetes, it is very hard today to get over that restriction, as in accidentally shoot yourself in the foot there. So you have some safety already guaranteed by the underlying orchestrator. And then once, as soon as you have that single reader-writer mode, there's a lot of caching that can be performed on the local system. You can control when you want to flush stuff and you don't want to. It's easier to understand because it's just one relatively smaller system compared to a much larger distributed file system. And that'll derive better performance for most categories of applications. They can work better at it versus a shared file system, which has different caching and consistency semantics.
Okay, so that's a very fair point. If you know that your workload is going to be single writer, that's a very different scenario to an environment where you're connecting devices that you can't 100% guarantee are going to be safely locked to a particular container or pod. Mm-hmm. So that in itself I agree with. I can see that point. The challenge there is, though, I think, is what happens if I want to share that data or do something else with it? How do I understand what that data belonged to as part of an application before I move it around? So think of an example where I have a cluster. And one of the nodes in my cluster dies. Another node, another pod somewhere else is going to bring that data up, and I still want to reuse that load. I don't want to lose that. How am I going to make sure I've got enough metadata to make that happen?
Okay, it's a great question. As with any distributed system, consistency in the face of failures is very, very hard to do. However, a lot of people have done that hard work to make it a little bit more reliable. So you have quorum-based systems, you have consensus protocols such as Raft and Paxos that all of these systems use. So you can do this safely where even if there's a network partition, and you might have a live node, just the rest of the system can't see it. Through a consensus-based mechanism, it is possible to safely say, okay, it is okay to unmount this, because the person on the other side of the partition might have given up the lock and then remounted somewhere else for reuse. And that is, I think, a great value add. But I think some of the world is shifting from the traditional point of view that we see here, where when we look at things from the perspective of these microservice-based applications, we have observed that a lot of these challenges are being solved at the application layer versus the storage layer. So what you talked about, a host going away and a LUN not being visible anymore, it's now handled at maybe the Cassandra MySQL layer with replication. So even if a MySQL node goes away, another one with a copy of that data, sharded or not, is still available to serve data. This could be an example across different regions in a public cloud, or different availability zones rather.
Okay, all right, I get that, but I'd like to question how much that really gets built into applications these days. Is that a big part of the way that applications are being built? Or do you think, I would look at it and say that I could imagine people being a little bit lazy and saying, well, I don't need to do that because I've got persistent storage to help me out there. I'll just create a single image and or even use a pod as the recovery mechanism.
So in short, not as many as I'd like, but more than I've seen in the VM-centric world is what we are observing out there with customers.
Okay.
It is easier today to set up replication. It's easier to get resiliency because the underlying system, in this case Kubernetes, is taking care of some of the orchestration for you, for restarting nodes, things of that nature. So we are seeing more of those. But I agree with you, and it's never a black or white kind of answer, but I agree with you that there are certain use cases where maybe a distributed file system is better, where you're bringing applications in that were built for distributed file. We see a lot of this in financial services. There are big SMB or NFS users internally, and when they're moving to a public cloud, they want to take this shared file system access over because that's what the developers are used to. And that's also the pattern that they've always built. They run into other issues sometimes in a public cloud with file systems. But there, I think there is a use case, but I think it's 20-25% of the workloads out there.
Okay.
Most people will be happy with block today in this environment.
Okay, so imagine I am going to build something where I've got some sort of block device connected in.
Mm-hmm.
How are technologies like CSI helping in that? Because I wrote something mm-hmm. not that long ago about CSI, and I looked at it and thought, yeah, it's got some good features.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be lacking in certain areas.
Mm-hmm.
How is that developing to really sort of answer some of those challenges?
So personally, I am very excited about CSI for a number of reasons. So for people who are not familiar with CSI, it is the container storage interface.
Yeah, it's nothing to do with an American police show,
yes,
or anything like that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No law enforcement involved,
yes,
here.
Yeah.
But yeah, so this is the container storage interface. It came out as a collaborative effort between multiple companies. But primarily today, it's used within Kubernetes, as that is the biggest container orchestrator out there. Now, what CSI has done is that it's abstracted away implementations for storage systems underneath the hood. So you don't need to know what necessarily this application will bind to at runtime. You just make a call saying, give me the storage volume, could be file, could be block, with these characteristics when your application starts off. And that gives you freedom of choice underneath the hood, moving across vendors or having the same application be truly portable and run across multiple environments in a public cloud on-prem. So that's CSI.
Okay. Now, sorry to interrupt, but first things first on that. From that layer upwards,
mm-hmm.
the CSI layer upwards, I see that as being really good. So
mm-hmm.
the ability to abstract away and not have to care what the underlying physical infrastructure of the storage looks like,
mm-hmm.
big tick in the box, because nobody wants to have to write to many different types of storage.
Mm-hmm.
And let's face it, that's a technique that's been used across the
mm-hmm.
industry forever.
Yes.
You know, even going back to the days of the PC where you'd write a driver for a screen, you know, for a model of graphics card or something
mm-hmm.
like that. So that's great. Going down, though, the first thing I think there is that somebody now needs to hold metadata that tells me how I map that data to that container
mm-hmm.
or pod, and exactly how it maps to the physical infrastructure on
mm-hmm.
that storage
yeah.
layer.
Mm-hmm.
So how has that been handled? Is that natively within certain products, or is that the vendor has to do some work there?
Mm-hmm. So unfortunately, the story there isn't great. Metadata has always been the bane of most storage systems. And as you've covered in other articles too,
yeah.
it is increasingly important today. So what happens today is it is unfortunately being held at multiple layers. And this is something that at Kasten we're also working on addressing, because you see Kubernetes as a part of its runtime state mapping, this application maps as a storage, but if that cluster went away, poof, you might have lost that metadata. Storage vendors will sometimes replicate some of that information in their internal catalogs,
yeah.
but really don't always have that visibility into the application. They might have labels, etc., and push come to shove, in a day or two you might be able to recover. But again, there's that mismatch in metadata. So this is a real problem right now. And once you have diversity, especially in the enterprise of storage systems, Kubernetes clusters,
yeah.
data centers, it's much more complicated.
Yeah, and I see there a big problem as well when you go cross-vendor.
Mm-hmm.
So when you go cross-cloud, you can't rely on things like tags and labels, because things like that are free form.
Mm-hmm.
And they're, you know, unless somebody maintains them or there is some sort of clever logic to them when they're created by the system,
mm-hmm.
you might be okay. But outside of that, you've then got a major hassle, because there's no consistency when you say on an AWS cluster to when you're running something on premises. So
yeah.
it sounds like there's still a bit of work around that area to do.
That is correct, right? That's why one of the things that we do in our product is we are focused on just cloud native data management. So backup recovery, disaster recovery, but also cross cluster mobility. And the big thing we built out first was this metadata layer. That is a global catalog that can capture where data is, how it associates with applications. So no matter whether you want to roll back in time, want to reuse data for something, this metadata is present there, because none of the layers by themselves can give the customer what they're looking for.
Okay. So let's assume I'm a couple of years out of date,
mm-hmm.
and I'm trying to get an idea of what's actually current
mm-hmm.
and what's been done in the last 2 years. Where do we even start about how to identify what's changed in the industry since my sort of view on it?
So let's see. I think there's been a change in the importance of certain design patterns. People increasingly focus on things like reliability, resiliency, security. It shows up a lot more. There's been an increase in the use of applications across multiple environments, whether you call it hybrid cloud, multi-cloud, there has been that. But also now we're seeing, and I'm very encouraged by this, changes in the way these storage systems are being built underneath the hood.
Okay.
So you have the common interface. So let's not change what the application developers do. Let's not change how they write, whether it be a POSIX file system API or something else. How they access storage should not change. But it's not just fast media underneath the hood that's changing, but also how these systems are being built. When I look at Rancher's Longhorn, which was recently, I believe, accepted as a CNCF incubating project, or some of the stuff coming out with a couple of other vendors, they're saying, how do we take these large monolithic systems and break them up? Why can't I have 10,000 storage arrays in my system where each array is its own essentially block device or a few block devices that service an application? They're pushing the boundary. It's the next couple of years will tell us how that actually goes and whether they can solve the management pain of that, because no such thing as a free lunch here.
Yeah.
But it increases resiliency because your blast radius is reduced. It increases lowers the risk of upgrades in the system because you can do it piecemeal. So there are a number of interesting design patterns that are coming out driven by just these microservice container-based architectures that are constantly auto-scaling, upgrading, and applying that to storage systems is an interesting development we've seen recently.
Okay. I mean, that idea of virtual storage arrays is a really fascinating one. And that's something I'm trying to think when I even wrote about that the first time. It's been something that I've talked about a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
Mainly, probably, I guess, since... So it must be, 2002 maybe, when Hitachi brought in virtualization on their storage platform, the USP.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reason I thought that was really interesting was because if I was doing migration between platforms, I could actually say, if it was a virtual system,
mm-hmm.
I could migrate my application to a new physical platform,
mm-hmm.
because what would move would be the virtual implementation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what would be really interesting is to see whether you could migrate what looked like a virtual set of definitions from a private cloud infrastructure into mm-hmm. something like Amazon or Azure or something like that. That would be a really interesting design concept to allow.
See, I think it's interesting, but from my point of view, I don't know whether that's a good thing to do.
Okay.
All right, because just because you can doesn't always mean you should. And this boils down, this actually ties together a few things we've already talked about, such as CSI, portability, etc. Because I don't know if I want to take my NetApp system to a public cloud. NetApp will disagree with me.
Oh, God, yeah, they will. They'll be very happy to do that. Don't worry.
But in the same way that I don't know if I necessarily want to take EBS to my on-premises data center, right? I believe our customers should be able to pick whatever is the best thing for the environment they're running.
Yeah.
Whether it's battle-hardened EBS that so many people and millions of applications have used, or NetApp in the exact data center environment you know and trust. So no matter what environment you're, I think you should be able to migrate the entire application stack. So that use case is definitely there for so many reasons. But you should be able to move it independent of the storage implementation underneath. And right, this is one of these things where there's complexity underneath the hood, but be able to address it, again, like what we are working on right now, there's a lot of power for the customer to be able to do that versus saying, let me bring my NetApp into the cloud with me and try to jump through hoops to make that work, versus mm-hmm. saying, give me the freedom of choice. But again, this insulation or rather this, the way we've scoped down storage systems help there. Being able to make that move.
Okay, I'm going to throw a little bit of a spanner in the works here.
Yeah.
So something I was even just thinking about yesterday, actually, funny enough. And I was looking at the idea of where we went when we went to virtualization, server virtualization,
yes. Is,
and then how we went to containers. And if you look at the way that the virtual environments were built, they're built very much to have a lot of the plumbing, shall we call it, infrastructure plumbing, sorted as part of the hypervisor. So we've seen networking, we've seen storage, we've seen the ability to actually dispatch those virtual machines, all managed by the hypervisor.
Mm-hmm.
When we went to containers, we didn't get that.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't get any of the storage constructs. We didn't really have the networking, especially in the Docker era.
Yes.
Not to pick on Docker, but just in general.
Mm-hmm.
And I just look at it and think, are we in a situation where the simplification has translated into more and more features going into storage add-ons or networking add-ons to container and Kubernetes environments, mm-hmm. and storage just being, for example, just being really simple and needing to just deliver a very small, simple set of functions.
You know, I'm in strong agreement with that. I honestly wish storage systems did one thing and one thing well.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of innovation there, don't get me wrong. It's not an easy topic. It's actually a complex topic with constantly shifting technology underneath there.
Yeah.
But if they do that well, and going to the back to the issue of, you know, software-defined infrastructure, if you've done that well in that environment, I think there's more power that you build things on top of it versus trying to just have a single system that tries to do it all. Because then you don't have focus, you don't have the separation of concerns, and you don't get that innovation because you're tying different layers of the stack to each other. So I'd actually really agree with you there that storage system should do what it does very well. And then you have the other ecosystem on top. When you go look at, you touched upon this with some of the plugins or add-ons, the platform or cluster add-ons in Kubernetes that give the application a lot more power, but they can work with multiple vendors underneath the hood there.
Yeah, I'm going to ask one really obvious question. Mm-hmm. And that's all the way along here, we've talked about storage and we've assumed that storage is either block or file. But actually, first of all, we know we have object storage as well. Mm-hmm. So let's call it unstructured and block or whatever. Mm-hmm. But in reality, are we thinking too simplistically here? Are we actually in a position where we should be thinking about higher level storage functions where data is stored not in a block or a file system, mm-hmm. but in a structured format or in other formats or in documents that are mm-hmm. natively served by the platform?
So I believe the answer to that one is yes. We're seeing some companies already at the forefront of this. For example, when we talk to customers today, one of the questions we ask them is often, what storage do you use? And the answer has been shifting. It used to be EBS, NetApp, Dell EMC. We now hear Cassandra, MySQL, Postgres. And these are not just from developers that have entered the environment of the workforce in the last few years. These are from people that have deep background in storage and data management. And that's the way they're approaching the problem now. So I completely see the point where structured data storage is becoming a first-class citizen. And when you see Vitesse as an example that PlanetScale is commercializing, when you see Yugabyte, CockroachDB, they have all said the same way we talked about reinventing how block and file systems are built today.
Yep.
They're trying to reinvent how structured data works in this large scale-out environment. And both of those, it's a symbiotic loop between the cloud-native infrastructure and the structured storage systems, where they're each supporting each other and making it a lot more useful so that the developer ultimately doesn't worry about, is this going to be available, is this going to be resilient? It's all, in some sense, baked into the infrastructure they can consume.
Okay. I mean, do you think that's derived from the cloud-native way of working, and that's why we've seen that come along as an option?
Yes, right? So just to make it very clear, I'm not saying just have a managed service in your environment. Right? You just manage MySQL, Postgres. No. I think the answer here is different because it is influenced by the fact that the cloud native infrastructure people believe things will always go down. Things will be failing, things will be scaling, workloads will change dynamically, new applications, new services that consume these structured data services will show up.
Yep.
So how do you react to that in real time without an admin being involved? And all of those both requirements as well as the primitives provided that make it much easier to build compared to, say, 10 years ago, have influenced the growth of these newer generation of structured storage systems.
Okay, I'm really interested to see how that might work if you were running in an on-prem environment or, mm-hmm. or a cloud environment. I can sort of say a public cloud environment because effectively somebody like Amazon will just obfuscate that behind the scenes and mm-hmm. they could have dozens of guys running around pressing buttons.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or not, or they may have automated mm-hmm. it all. That seems to be a bit more of a challenge when you come on-prem
mm-hmm.
to build that sort of environment. So all the vendors that are building things like that can fit that. So, I mean, you mentioned a few, but mm-hmm. you know, where do we think that's going to go? How is that going to be delivered?
So I think we need to step back a second. On-prem isn't going away, especially in the enterprise.
Yeah.
5 years ago, people said 70% of the workloads in the next 7-8 years will be in the public cloud. That hasn't happened. It's not like on-prem is increasing, but it's a significant component of the enterprise. And a lot of these systems that we just spoke about also do or are already in deployment in these on-prem environments. What has helped is a common substrate, that is Kubernetes. That is, it has helped to have the system that they can deploy in, so they aren't worrying about Snowflake, VMware environments as an example, and be able to get up and running and to deliver these services for customers out there.
So we could just build, for example, like a Cassandra app that you can just, that the developer just goes in and says, I want one of those. And it becomes a few parameters and it's built and running. And it's his... it's his Cassandra environment. How we choose to put that onto physical storage is another discussion, because obviously that's built into the into the definition. But is that the way you see it? These become like consumable services that you can run on-prem, or is that too simplified?
You know, it's funny. I don't know whether you meant to do this consciously or not, but this goes back to our block and file discussion, where the two design patterns that we see that are similar, where similar to distributed file system, which is a common large file system, we see sometimes large clusters of, say, Cassandra that people carve up into their own space.
Right.
Or you can see a lot more of individual clusters, which we see also, right? We're speaking to this customer in helping protect their Redis infrastructure. And they have over 500 instances of Redis clusters, so multiple Redis instances in each one, because that's how they have built out the infrastructure.
Okay.
So we have seen multiple patterns emerge in the same way when you look at block versus file show up in this environment too. And I think the answer is it depends. We shouldn't be prescriptive. We should be meeting customers where they are. And it's about their use cases and servicing both of those.
Okay. Now, I'm going to challenge you now, because here's the bit where we flip from what sounds all great and wonderful and has to come down to a bit of reality, because I come from an enterprise background.
Yes.
So inevitably, one of the things I always look at is when we talk about this from security, from an operational perspective, from a data management perspective, and from all of those things that you need to operationalize, if that's a real word, a workload when you put it into production, somehow we've still got to fix all those problems. I'll give you an example. If I'm an auditor and I'm coming along looking at this application, and you tell me the application only exists whilst these pods are spun up, and when if they all shut down, all that data and everything would be gone, I'd be a little bit nervous.
More than a little bit, yes.
So clearly, somehow we've got to align some of the things we've just talked about to some of the things that within the enterprise are going to be expected to deliver, you know, against compliance and all of those other things.
Day two needs is what you've described.
Okay.
Right, is a large unmet need in this environment.
I read something about, what's his name? Jeff Bezos. Where apparently the first building that they moved into, it was called Day One.
Yes.
And then not until a bit later did they move to another building called Day Two. So yeah, interesting use of the term.
Yes. So a lot of what we talked about, bringing something up, installing a storage system, provisioning storage, those are all day one actions. The real issues and the real challenges, I believe, show up in day two.
Okay.
That is, how do you manage the life cycle of these applications? And more than your applications, your data. Now, both of those are very tied at the hip as far as Kubernetes is concerned. State that needs to sit on disk, moved into the app. But either way, it's what you talked about. How do I go back to a state of the system a week ago, a day ago, an hour ago? How do I know what forms the application? This is rapidly changing, scaling up and down, people are deploying new services, redeploying. And that's why we created Castanier, to really solve those data management challenges, because a lot of focus so far has been on day one.
That wasn't a setup for you, by the way. I didn't deliberately just, I didn't tee that up. That was a genuine question that I wanted to...
But because it is a genuine problem.
Yes.
And we saw this ourselves, right? So my first customer-facing app went live in 2015, running on Kubernetes. So pre-1.0 days. And we had all these issues. And we were working on them so that our customers don't need to in the enterprise space. That is, how do you do backups? How, if something goes down, if you have a ransomware attack, right? How do you deal with these things?
Yeah.
How do you protect access to this data, not just from the application point of view, but from the backup admin or admin, and carve roles out? All of that is a really, really big deal in the enterprise. And unfortunately, all the systems people use for VM-based infrastructure, whether you look at the Commvault to the NetBackup to the Veeams of the world, really just do not work in this new cloud-native environment, right? Point blank. And so how do you tackle those is a big focus for what we do here, because we genuinely believe in solving these important pain points for our customers.
Yeah, I can see things like as people scale and grow, there's going to be that scenario where people decide, how do they deploy onto multiple clusters for sake of argument? How do they go cross-vendor? How do they really go hybrid? Mm-hmm. There's some really tough challenges to solve there.
Yes, it's tough around performance, around cost, around security, around data sovereignty, when you're looking at places in Europe as an example.
Yeah.
So that is a very significant component of what we do, because these are the hard challenges. That is, if I am moving from US East to US West, that is one set of complex challenges, because I'm moving the entire app stack, not just my disk volumes in this world. But it's more than that. What if I'm running, going from Google to AWS? Now, no one does that on an hourly basis. But you sometimes want that off-site or off-cluster backup. So we have a production customer for over 9 months that has been, on a daily basis, taking everything they capture from Google and moving it into their own private data center where they do restore testing. Very important app for them.
Okay.
So these applications are live, and how do they do it with effective costs? Right? How do you leverage deduplication, network performance? How do you leverage fat pipes with high latency? So those are a lot of the issues that go into making this problem tractable without dictating that, oh, you must run the same storage system on both sides, because that's, again, replication, not backups. So those are some of the tough problems that we're tackling right now.
Yeah, that's a good point. Mm-hmm. That last one you just mentioned, I mean, if you look at a lot of enterprises, they would assume, well, I put box X from vendor Y on this side, I need to do the same on the other side. And mm-hmm. they tend to do that mainly because the replication technology between the two is optimized mm-hmm. by that vendor for its own technology.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Whereas in reality, it probably isn't always. I've seen one customer who did this. It isn't always that good to have the same technology at both sides, because if you get a bug or some sort of issue in one, the chances are you can experience it in the other when you fail over. So actually, it'd be better to have disparate systems in that scenario.
Yeah. Google actually has a term for that. They call it the query of death.
Okay.
Where the same query will bring down all your replicas together because the same bug gets resurfaced everywhere.
Yeah, everywhere. Yeah, yep. So there's good reason not to do that. That's pretty clear. Okay. Now we've gone through where we think we were, where we are today, and now we really should talk about where we think things might go. And obviously, storage itself, for as an example, and hardware in general, we see lots of new technologies come along, whether that's NVMe, GPUs, you know, all sorts of things. So is there anything that we can see on the horizon that might even completely change our view about how we should do this and actually takes us away from some sort of shared storage environment altogether?
That's a great point, Chris. When I look at the environment, we see customers seriously exploring even moving away from shared storage and say, I want to just use local NVMe for better performance, for better cost economics, instead of using shared storage. But it is not like they just want to put data they can easily recreate or use it as a cache. They want to use it for persistent data that is business critical. They say replication will take care of some of these issues. And in fact, I'm very excited about Kubernetes, because they saw these patterns, and not just CSI, but they've introduced features such as local volume provisioning. So it makes it easy to schedule containers that bind to local storage, as an example.
Yeah.
But it obviously creates a host of other issues around data management. But that is a pattern that we, I believe, will see more of as people use local devices for persistent data versus just caches or throwaway data.
Yeah, and perhaps as well tied to that, you could look at it and say NVMe over fabrics, mm-hmm. where we're not tied to having connectivity from one host to the set of devices in the same chassis. You know, we could have a rack scale environment where mm-hmm. all the storage is, in inverted commas, air quotes, centralized, mm-hmm. but not for anything more than from the practicality of putting it in one area, mm-hmm. and then you access it across the fabric. Mm-hmm. That in itself is shared storage, but not, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
It's more like shared DAS. Is that mm-hmm. even a term,
yep.
shared DAS? And maybe things like that might be more practical for these environments, because then you've got the maintenance ability, but you mm-hmm. don't necessarily have the expense and cost of building a shared storage environment.
That is correct. It's a different architectural pattern, and we're going to see some more of that. And I believe, excited about that. I also believe we'll see a lot more of the structured data services we talked about. as people started seeing, the same way they started seeing more object storage in the environment,
yeah,
and something they could depend on, I think we'll start seeing similar stuff in this environment too, where they'll see structured data just being a part of the environment. Maybe it moves a little lower down the stack,
yeah,
than staying at the data services or application layer.
Okay. Oh, well, it's going to be interesting to see what comes up. So, Niraj, for anybody who wants to find you as a company,
mm-hmm,
find you as a person, stalk you online, you know, people might want to follow you and understand some of the comments and the feedback you, mm-hmm, you know, you've been giving online. So where can people go and find you?
Great. So I am very easy to find online. You can find a company at kasten.io. That's kasten.io. You can find me at Neeraj Tolle on Twitter, but plug my name into Google. There'll be multiple ways to find me, the company, K10, our data management product, and we'd love to hear from the audience.
Great. By the way, when you're a Chris Evans, it's really hard putting your name into Google and finding you. It's actually much more complicated, but that's a story for another day. But for now, thanks for your time, and look forward to catching up soon.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Storage Unpacked. For show notes and more, subscribe at storageunpacked.com. Follow us on Twitter at Storage Unpacked or join our LinkedIn group by searching for Storage Unpacked Podcast. You can find us on all good podcatchers, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.